And welcome back to the Research VR Podcast, everyone, the podcast behind the science and design of virtual reality. I am your host, Oz Balabanian, and with me today is special guest Alexander Porter, the co-founder of Scatter and the creator of DepthKit. Hi, Alexander.
Hi there. Good to be here.
Yes, and of course, beaming in from Germany, we have Mr. Peter Leckoff.
Yeah, beaming in with the speed of light. Hello, everyone.
Speed of whatever, like, internet transmission fibers can give. But so, Alexander, hi, I'm glad you're here on the podcast. Today, we're going to talk about, again, one of my favorite topics, volumetric filmmaking. This includes everything like photogrammetry, point clouds, and depth cameras. And I think we had one episode, actually, with Asad J. Malik, with his film Terminal 3. So we kind of got we talked about content and about how, like, augmented reality filmmaking happens. So today we're talking to you about how he was actually filming using DepthKit. So, and you guys are the people that make it. So we'll go a little bit deeper into how do the cameras for volumetric filmmaking work? How does even the ecosystem work? How do you approach it? How is it so different than everything else? So it's going to be a pretty fun conversation. Why don't you give us a little bit of a background of yourself, how you kind of ended up in the VR, AR space, and where you find yourself today?
Yeah, so I started my career and my creative life as a photographer, actually. I had fallen in love with the kind of craft and practice and politics of documentary photography. And I trained in it. And so it made a career of it, and I ended up photographing many, many things. So fundamentally, it was about the power of imagery to affect change, affect the world and our perception of it. And I did that for quite a while. And I reached a point where my kind of slightly childhood hope for what this craft was started to meet the world. And I started to realize that actually my job was just more like a photocopier in a way, the kinds of work I was taking on required me to take more like a bulk of images than the kind of powerful individual specific, kind of meaningful individual images. And I think that's a product largely of our time. So I reached a bit of a crisis of faith. And around that time, I met a person who's now my business partner and longtime collaborator, James George. We started to experiment with how to expand the form of photography. And specifically, my sort of little moment of crisis was I was on tour with Rihanna, the musician Rihanna, on a plane. And there was the tour was called the 777 tour. And the gimmick was that it was seven shows in 7 days in seven cities on a 777 airplane. And
it's a big plane.
It was ridiculous. It represented for me this perfect example of what I just didn't want to be doing, which was creating a mass of meaningless images. And on that flight, I was reading a little book of kind of media theory and philosophy by a philosopher named Willem Flusser, and it specifically dealt with this idea that the cameras have a kind of inherent craving. They sort of have a hunger. There's something that's encoded into them, which is just to take as many photographs as possible from any angle to capture the surface of the entire world. And he described this kind of concept of a person that was an experimental photographer, a person who isn't controlled by the wills and wants of the camera, but actually modifies what's possible, modifies the camera itself as a means for expression. And I found that reading this book, and it's kind of interesting that philosophy kind of actually has an impact in your life sometimes. So I was reading this book, and it totally drove me off the edge in terms of the craft I was in, and left me with a sense of craving what was next, and craving the ability to just kind of smash the camera as it's currently designed, and elaborate and build it for specifically what I wanted to be able to create. So it left me with a new question, which is what kind of experiences, stories, images, etc., would I want to create if I had the freedom to define the tool itself? And so enter this new dear friend and collaborator, James George, who has a background in computer graphics and fine art, we started to experiment. And initially what we did was we took the first generation of the Xbox Kinect. So this was late 2010, early 2011. And for those who don't know, the Kinect is it's a depth sensor. Really what it is a natural user interface. It's a hands-free controller. It has a lot in common with this hand control I'm using with the Rift right now. But it has this other capacity, and you guys know this, but it has this other capacity, which is that it's a depth sensor. It's kind of an accidental depth sensor. And it represented a dream come true for an entire generation of computer vision experts in academia, in science, et cetera. All of the hopes and dreams suddenly were out in people's homes, in people's living rooms. And so we started to experiment with it. And we built prototypes where we were attaching cameras to the Kinect, and starting to evaluate what can happen if you both have this stream that initially was designed for a computer C, and you start to expose it as a kind of visual form in itself. And so we started to make our own tools and make our own art projects at the time. And so this went on to become what's now the Depth Kit, which is a volumetric capture tool. But so this was my entree into this. And we ended up sort of taking these ideas, very simple ideas in some way, like a combination of a high resolution camera that is designed for kind of human consumption and human appreciation, and combining it with computer vision and computational photography devices to make something that's more than a photograph and more than footage.
And you also had a Kickstarter project back then, right?
We did. We've had quite a few. So we from there, what we did was in order for James and I to collaborate, we basically had to create tools. My background is not in engineering and development. I'm very competent and proficient and frankly kind of obsessed with the details, but I don't have that training. And so James basically wrote visual interfaces so that I could use these tools. We realize now that we're sort of accidentally doing product development, right? It's like in that moment, he would not need the tools that I eventually needed. And that represented, in order to be able to solve the problem for both of us, it represented the kind of nascent moment of a product, right? And so what we did was we took that tool and we released the interfaces in kind of an open source or more like a freeware mode. And people started to get obsessed with it. People started to use it for their creative practices, to build projects against it. So in the early days, there was Eminem made a music video. There were a lot of kind of beautiful projects that people created. And I was using our tool, right? And it was free and easy to download and use the original Kinect. And so built off this tool, James started to collaborate with another guy named Jonathan Menard on a project called Clouds. And I think this is probably the Kickstarter you're referring to. And Clouds was a volumetric and an interactive experience that talks about or kind of tells the story of people who create with code. So this is people, this is artists for whom their kind of primary medium is programming. And we kind of are part of a community here in New York that's defined by that. And specifically a focus on a few communities. There's a kind of tool set called Processing and another one called Open Frameworks, which are these kind of prototyping tool sets where a lot of times you will get designers/coders who can use these tools to very quickly elaborate on creative ideas. So it was sort of centered around these communities, and it was an extraordinarily beautiful, very elaborate, kind of nonlinear volumetric experience. At the end, it was about 10 hours of footage that can be traversed in a nonlinear way. And it's very aesthetically beautiful. It was art directed by a guy named G Monk, who's an extraordinary kind of designer. He'd worked on a lot of projects, a lot of kind of science fiction and kind of visual effects projects to date. So there was a Kickstarter that was run for that. And we actually made a kind of conscious choice at the moment. We were debating whether we should kickstart the tool itself and kind of expand its capabilities in the community, or to start with a project. And we ended up choosing to start with this project. And the creation of clouds really made this tool as powerful and kind of robust as it is today. Because obviously we had to conduct a lot of interviews. And this project, again, was directed by James or co-directed by James and this guy, Jonathan Menard. So that was our kind of first Kickstarter to your question. And from there, we, after the completion of that project, and the project did very well, it premiered at, I think I have this right, at the Sundance Film Festival. And it premiered alongside, it was a very interesting moment in VR. So we started the project before before the Rift Kickstarter. So it was sort of in a pre-VR, not literally pre-VR, but pre-popular VR world. And we realized as we saw the Kickstarter, as we started to get the hardware, that we had been doing work that was assuming virtual reality for a number of years till then. And literally we would give these talks, these kind of futurist oriented talks, where we would say, you know, in the future, the kind of role of the photographer, the cinematographer, will be almost like a post-production task. You will film the entire world and the viewer will guide their own way through the story. And people will go, that's ridiculous. Like, what are you talking about? These guys are kind of off on a different planet. And so when virtual reality eventually emerged, it was like, oh, this is the fulfillment of this thing that we've been anticipating and building for. And so this Clouds project ended up getting adapted for virtual reality. And so it was premiered at Sundance in a really interesting context. It was sort of a moment that represented the origins of a few streams of what we now call virtual reality, where you had the Eve Valkyrie project was premiering there. You had Chris Milks Beck, the 360 head project. I forget what it's called. And then you had this project Clouds. And it was very interesting because each of these kind of became originating projects in a few different disciplines, right? You have the kind of evolution of video gaming, and then you have this sort of 360 video project. And then you have what we now call volumetric filmmaking, which Clouds was kind of a really defining project in that space. So that was one of the first ways that we started to engage with what volumetric filmmaking could really be. And there's a couple notes about that project. It's really extraordinary that it's still available. And one of the interesting things is, so it's a volumetric project where you use the Rift, and you see people almost like apparitions out in front of you, volumetrically captured. And it streams, and this is a bit of a kind of technical insight, but it's streaming from a platform that was then called VHX, which has since been acquired by Vimeo. Remotely from a server. So it's 10 hours long, but it doesn't mean that you have to have all that locally on your machine. So you watch this thing, you get this really beautiful thumb drive or download it, plug it in, and the system is traversing the graph ahead of you and basically downloading the material that you need in order for your experience to be seamless well ahead of time. So for us, this represents...
These are point clouds?
They are. I mean, a point cloud is just a rendering technique, right? So it's fundamentally it's volumetric data. The intermediary format for us is actually video in this case. And then we rendered it with a shader as a point cloud. And it's kind of somewhere, it's a beautiful kind of effect that somewhere between point cloud, a kind of mesh appears and texture appears occasionally and a wireframe all kind of mixed together.
Right. But you guys actually use video encoding as the medium to transport the data between, that's what you actually are downloading and decoding into volumetric data.
Yeah, and that's set us up obviously uniquely to collaborate with this team at VHX, who were formerly from Vimeo, so they're video engineers. They're also artists and friends. They're amazing. It enables us to collaborate with them well, right? Because they're in the business of moving videos around. And it also meant that we could stream and we could compress and all the things that you need.
Yeah. So I will have a few questions about the technological part, but maybe you could continue first. How is the projects that you did further developed? So where did it all move on after you presented it during this festival?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so that project specifically... obviously my kind of collaborators, the co-directors, would be better to speak to this, but it ended up showing at the Tribeca Film Festival. It won an award there, the jury award there. It was shown at the MoMA. I feel like I have the special opportunity as not one of the directors to really gloat about this project. I think it's a really beautiful one. So it went on to be very well received. And I think one of the most powerful things about it is it's a really meaningful document of this community at a specific time. And that it's important to me with VR or any storytelling to talk about what you're actually doing, not just the means, not just the tech, et cetera, but ask yourself, am I making something meaningful at the end of the day? And with this project, it's very much true. It's a documentary, very thoroughly researched and well-seen capture of a community in a specific moment. So that's sort of where that particular project went on to. And in terms of our practice, so James and I continued to work together, and we founded a kind of a design consultancy, a company where we were making interactive installations in a lot of cases. We started doing a kind of a combination of art projects and occasional kind of commercial or consulting projects. And we ended up in this interesting space where we would do kind of design research by oftentimes we would be asked to imagine what a certain technology might look like in the future and then implement an installation that actually describes that. That's a way of imagining what the future will be. There's a whole set of disciplines that use this kind of work as a mechanic. There's design fiction, the sort of embodied by people like Bruce Sterling, Neal Stephenson, etc. And then there's a practice called speculative design, where this is a way of actually doing design work. You imagine what will be possible in the future, and then you go and build that, and that becomes a kind of an inspiration for what people can do. And so one of the most notable projects we did in that way was with the Prime Minister's office in Dubai. We worked with kind of in collaboration with another company to build the future of government services in Dubai. So specifically they wanted us to kind of imagine what the future of technology in Dubai could actually look like. And so we build these very big, very kind of elaborate and technically complex installations for them as a way to visualize this. And then they shared that with kind of leaders, business and kind of NGO and political leaders of the world. Very weird and kind of a really interesting process. It speaks to this, something that's very prominent in virtual reality, which is the relationship between fiction and the human imagination and what actually gets made. And I think a kind of not insignificant amount of the technologies that we have today are driven by the kind of teenage fantasies or teenage imaginations of engineers, if we're honest, right? And obviously there's more rigor in many places, but that is often kind of how we get here. And so
no, absolutely.
I can't tell you how many times we've heard about kind of fantasies about the holodeck in reference to volumetric filmmaking. My hope is actually that we can take those, celebrate them, love our childhoods, right? And actually start to build something beyond that, something that's genuinely new that you couldn't have imagined in a movie in the 80s, you know? We worked in that way for a little while, and we started to realize that people were starting to get very insistent about our volumetric tool. It was out for free, and people were just getting obsessed. They wanted it, and they wanted it to evolve.
Why do you think that is? Is it maybe because like Kinects were readily available to be bought and you know, start filming in versus other experimental forms of filmmaking like that required, maybe even at that time, 360 videos were hard to do. You needed to actually build your own GoPro rig and do the stitching yourself. Do you think maybe like the technology that was available was like driving the demand as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that fundamentally all of this stuff is about people's imagination for what's coming next, right? So I think that we had, the first point I'll make is that we started, like the display, we had an input that we'd created, this volumetric filmmaking toolkit, right? And then suddenly an output, like a display that was a native and sensible display for that emerged. And when both of those factors were present, suddenly people started to understand the relevance of it. And a lot of our kind of beta testers and kind of early users, they really see themselves as the creators of the future, like people who are investigating, thinking deeply and critically about what's next. And I think the writing felt on the wall for a lot of these people. And the other thing is, like you're saying, yeah, 360 video came out, and I've never had much of a passion for a 360 video. I have seen extraordinary pieces and I celebrate its existence, but I've never personally been very interested in it. And I think a lot of people they were seeing 360 video, they were hearing what the promise was, and they were feeling like they were feeling like there was a unfulfilled promise that 360 video represented that it actually couldn't fulfill. And so a lot of those people started to come to us and say, okay, let's build what's next.
Yeah, I'd say that's a fair assessment. And I'd probably put one other factor as like the reason why there's a disconnect between the promise and the execution of 360 is that it kind of relies on video being a very easy form of video of content consumption, even compared to like text or any other forms of media. 360 almost is the opposite, where it is very taxing and requiring of the user to be like directly engaged in here watching. And there's almost, it almost goes counter to the advantages that normal video has, which is that you can actually drop, you know, you can put it in the background, you can kind of listen to it, you can engage with it when you want to. But I think there's a big difference there in experience and perhaps volumetric. The fact that it's not inherently, let's say, immersive, or it can be immersive, or you can also display it on a 2D screen, has certain advantages that 360 kind of inherently doesn't.
Yeah, I will say, though, it's a matter of taste. So, and I'm the first to admit that this is a matter of my personal aesthetics. Like, I just prefer one over the other. I don't like to entertain the conversation about what is truly immersive or what is true VR and what is not true VR. It's all not,
yeah,
fundamentally not
I
true,
agree with
let's
that.
Be honest. So I, for me, that's like that's a kind of a secondary point. It's kind of an academic kind of inside baseball point, like which one is more immersive or not immersive. And I'm excited about the emergence of a creative discipline. Like, again, for me, it all comes back to what are you making with it? And one of the incredible benefits of 360 video to date is that the production side is getting so much easier that we can actually start to make really meaningful stories. We can actually start to take these cameras out into the world and make stories that really matter. Whereas a story in your lab or your living room is not that interesting.
I think there is another side of the story too. So in a sense, it's also about the device you're consuming the medium on. So when you think about something like a YouTube video or like a movie, I ended up sometimes watching movies on my phone because I was too lazy getting up, right? I just take my phone, I just watch it on a small screen, but it's okay. With 360 video, before I had like an Oculus Go, I was literally too lazy to, you know, set up the headset, put it on, open, you know, some kind of browser and watch some kind of 360 video. When you're anyway spending some time in VR, sometimes you want to be lazy and you're ending up watching it more. And I think it's not just that the hardware itself became more accessible to the filmmakers, but I think also there's a learning process, and also a learning process not only by the people who make the movies. So, for example, the Mr. Robot 360 experience that I watched was like the first time it made me convinced that, because 360 video is awesome because it just fitted so nice into the narrative. But it took a long time where people actually produced something that really caught me on. But also the user, like me, myself, and everyone else who's using VR is getting more used towards it and is not overwhelmed so much by this amount of, oh, I have too much information. But it's actually, okay, I don't need to see everything. I just need to get, you know, the main story. And also, I would kind of not compare 360 with volumetric video, because volumetric video has just way different advantages and disadvantages. So they're literally not very well comparable in a sense, except you can, from the consumer perspective, argue they're similar. But technology-wise, and I also think storytelling-wise, they're just way more different, right?
Yes, fundamentally. And they're also in different moments. The early days of 360-degree video were like comically difficult. It was just so ridiculous and so tedious. And now it's, I'm not going to say it's easy. Again, I don't really dabble, but it's far easier. And we're in a very exciting early stage with volumetric filmmaking, where my incentive as a kind of business owner in this space is to tell you that it's very easy, but fundamentally it's not. There's an open landscape, and what that means is that there are so many options, and given that there are so many options, it can be very difficult. It can be very challenging, and also people's aspirations for it are so extraordinary that.
Let's maybe quickly explain what volumetric video is.
I think
maybe
that's a good
not
idea.
For everyone. It's not that clear. How would you describe the fundamental concept? What makes something volumetric?
Yeah, so we actually like to talk about it more as a discipline than as a technology, and we describe it. We call the discipline volumetric filmmaking, and it is. We're intending to embrace the pre-existing discipline of filmmaking because we think it's really extraordinary, and that many of the people that we're actually communicating are storytellers today, and they're actually many of them filmmakers today. And it's characterized by a bunch of different technologies that enable very interesting experiences. And those, as Oz was hinting at the beginning, those technologies tend to be ways of scanning or capturing the real world. And specifically, so given the ability to capture the real world, you can then bring it into a full immersive, explorable 360-degree environment like a game engine. And it creates whole new affordances that are not possible, have not been possible today, except occasionally in video games. And those are things like the ability to freely move through a space, for a story to be driven by your choices, for a story to adapt to what you should be seeing. Fundamentally, the ability to kind of move through the world is the thing that's most defining. And so as far as the kind of technologies that tend to enable this, it's for static captures, oftentimes it's a technique called photogrammetry, which you guys know about. Techniques like LiDAR, a lot of times we're borrowing from different disciplines. So oftentimes these technologies come from the worlds of preservation or archaeology, et cetera. Fundamentally, they're about capturing the world as it is. And so any of these technologies can be used to capture and create an environment. And then the main issue is always, how do I represent a human being? And I feel like the three of us are in a situation that characterizes that so dramatically, right? I'm in a body that doesn't even closely represent the one I actually have. And I'm looking at you guys in these kind of disembodied caricatures that are not actually representative of what you're like in the world. Now, certain environments, this is perfect for, I think. But when you start to want to tell documentary stories, real stories, stories that are true to a person's lived experience, you start to want to be able to see the person themselves. And so our kind of requirement for this is that you need to be able to have a plausible presence of a human being inside of your story. And that is the most difficult part. And part of it is because we're, as human beings, so attuned, so incredibly attuned to issues or kind of deviations or ways in which it's broken. And with volumetric filmmaking, what we do is we use a lot of these same techniques. We use 3D scanners and we combine them with cinematic cameras. And specifically with the depth kit, we use a camera, and usually a filmmaker will already have that camera. They already know where to start. And they will attach a 3D sensor to it. And we've used the Kinect version 2, the Kinect for Xbox One, to date. And it's actually quite an extraordinary sensor. We're using the Intel RealSense and a host of other sensors that are kind of out there and available for this. And specifically, we're very focused on the human presence. So what DepthKit allows you to do is you take these tools, you take them out into the field with your camera and your 3D sensor. You film using a computer. So I'll be recording what the depth sensor is seeing. I'll bring that back into the studio, and we have an editing tool set, a desktop editing tool set that allows you to align and to synchronize those streams, the depth and the color, and make a kind of meta format, a special kind of volumetric format out of that.
Can I bring up a small example? Because I think it's regards volumetric video, maybe not only, it's not just about the story, right? So one of our master students at a place I'm working for had a project where it was about capturing actually a surgery room, like doctors performing a surgery. And the idea was, we were doing it with Charité, and they thought, okay, how could we actually train nurses to figure out which tool to give to a person who is a doctor and who is operating the surgery. And she ended up, I think, not using DevsKit because I think you only support one or two Kinects, but she needed like three or four. And then she had to write some kind of meta format that in Unity would, you know, kick out the point clouds that were not moving or anything. But in the end, it was like a stitching from four Kinects and the RGB sensor inside some kind of volumetric place. And you could in Unity or in VR actually explore it and look around and look at the doctor from different perspectives. So while it's still the human, I think, I wouldn't, at least correct me if I'm wrong, but volumetric view is not just about humans, right? It's more about capturing the environment, the moving environment, and it can entail the humans. And I think most interesting parts to humans are as humans. And this is why your technology is so specific or so amazing. But in the end, I could also just walk around a room and capture maybe with a Tango tablet or photogrammetry and, you know, capture things moving there. And this would also, in theory, be volumetric video, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think I would just say yes. So for us, it's the presence of a human being is a very important aspect. It doesn't always need to be there, right? I think what defines volumetric filmmaking for us is this relationship with the real world and the use of these kinds of capture tool sets like photogrammetry, et cetera, you actually are going to see some pixels that actually represent what was initially captured. And it's also, it's to some degree defined as being distinct from conventional visual effects or gaming workflows where you start from nothing. You start from an empty scene and you build on that. You add vertices, you add faces, you add textures, et cetera, and you kind of sculpt from nothing. With this, you sort of start with everything. And anyone who's worked with this material knows that you get way too much. And so your job then becomes about selecting, about editing, and about reducing and making use of it. Mm-hmm.
Can you perhaps kind of describe the current landscape when it comes to volumetric filmmaking tools? Maybe you can kind of refer to like where DepthKit falls within. I'm sure people have heard of 8i, and Microsoft has their own capture stage now. There's a few other companies that are smaller. Kind of how is it a tier-based system currently? And if someone has a project, a filmmaker has a project, and depending on their budget, there's like different tiers that they can select. And where does DepthKit really what gap is it filling within that?
Yeah, it's a great question. It actually feels right now reminiscent of the early days of photography or the early days of film, where there are these extraordinary capture technologies that are springing up from all of the kind of major companies, right? So Intel has this beautiful kind of capture environment. And to paint a picture of what that looks like, it looks like most of them look like these massive sort of geodesic domes with tons of kind of green screen and lights and many, many, many cameras all facing inwards. And so you'll have this sort of single activated space in the center where your performance can happen. And it looks a little bit like a science fiction sort of teleportation device. It's this massive thing. I like to say that it's an architectural solution to filmmaking, right? Where you're actually creating a building that can do the filmmaking for you. And it's, for me, it's very reminiscent again of the early days of film and photography where, for example, if I was going to go and take a photograph, I needed a giant wagon and I needed to bring that with me. And I needed a massive team and maybe some horses. And it was a very intense process, right? It's very, very kind of slow and restrictive.
And very special. And
very specialized.
And that's just the capture process too, right? That's not even the actual
development.
Yes,
that's even more work.
Yeah, and so just to speak to where we believe that we sit, the most exciting moments for me in the history of photography, in the history of filmmaking, were things like the advent of like the Leica camera, for example. It came out, and suddenly what was rarefied and specialized was now general, and so you could actually we as the world started to see what was actually happening. You would see it in socioeconomic environments where the other cameras would never appear. We'd see them in world war zones. So, you know, we just discovered basically the Spanish Civil War in a way that we'd never seen wars before, for example, because suddenly there was a technology that could actually go to the place where things were happening. So we see ourselves that way. We think of this as a democratic tool. This is about volumetric filmmaking, leaving the lab, leaving the studio and entering the world. And so we have made very conscious choices, and we've been in this kind of world, in this game, for a very long time. We've maintained these choices all along, and that is to make sure that it's affordable, that it's mobile, and that it's as easy as possible. And
so maybe a question. Do I understand correctly that the only thing you technically need is a Kinect, which costs, I don't know, $200, like some kind of camera that you hopefully have anyway, and just your software, and in theory, that's all what you need?
That's correct. Yeah, and we are, it's a long project for us, and we're expanding our tool set into this kind of multi-camera environment. We've actually done a few projects that show this off. But yes, that is, in its simplest form, you can take a camera and a depth sensor and oftentimes a laptop or a tablet and go out into the world and capture stories. And so an example I can give you of this is there's a team that made this extraordinary project in North Africa that was that showed at Sundance this last year. It was made by a guy named Gabo Arora and a team called Sensorium here in New York. And they were in Tunisia, and they flew in, they put this thing in their backpack. They set this up and they were working in mosques and homes, et cetera. And they were able to, in the matter of a couple hours, to set up a shoot, conduct that shoot, wrap it up and take it home. And they made this extraordinary project that showed up at Sundance and was just totally, is well celebrated, and that's well deserving. It's a really extraordinary and beautiful project. And our commitment is to make that even easier. And to make more teams enabled to do that kind of work.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of structure sensors or what kind of sensors do you support? Because as far as I understand, the Kinect 2 is discontinued. Microsoft is planning some kind of new sensors. There's a RealSense sensor from Intel.
Yep. So I have a lot of sensors here. And we're constantly in the process of evaluating them and integrating them. Where we are in our kind of roadmap and our planning is that we've hired a team, and we are a team of really wonderfully gifted engineers, and we're in the process of rebuilding the tool sets that we had built for ourselves. And we have a beta program right now where there's a few hundred people who are actively using the tools that we initially created for ourselves, and we've kind of refined and updated a little bit. And we're in the process of a rebuild where the tool will make a massive leap in terms of usability, stability, speed, min spec, et cetera. And that's going to be coming out quite shortly. And as part of that process, we're increasingly integrating with new sensors. And so many of our users are still hanging on to their Kinect version 2s because it's quite an extraordinary device. Yeah. But we now support internally the Intel RealSense and a host of other sensors. We're actually quite excited about the...
I have to...
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say... finish your thought. Finish your thought and I'll add mine.
Oh, I was just going to say, there's this amazing kind of renaissance in depth sensing and kind of volumetric capture right now. And I will say that the Intel RealSense is not my favorite. And a lot of the other ones are kind of a lot more promising. We are excited about the Structure Core. It seems quite promising. Orbeck, I think, is doing really great work, et cetera.
That's kind of what I wanted to ask about is from my end, and I don't think I follow depth sensors that closely, but at least I keep up with it. I don't see them really taking off in any, well, not even taking off. I see less depth sensors being on the market today than there were like 2 years ago. With Kinect being... Maybe I'm wrong about this, actually. I'm happy to be corrected. But I guess, especially with Microsoft kind of discontinuing Kinect, the reason they did that is not because they don't see value in depth sensors, clearly because the HoloLens is built from their Kinect and their new, volumetric capture stage is using their new proprietary technology that they don't see any benefit in them releasing to the public. So they're just kind of keeping that all in-house. Let's see, Google Tango also basically, for them to do SLAM on a phone, they're just sticking to mono cameras anymore, and they don't want to require Google Tango hardware. So they discontinued that. RealSense, I guess, is the one bigger company that's continually producing new depth sensors, but perhaps their main idea is not for filmmaking and it's not for like depth sensing applications. So maybe can you tell us a little bit about are you optimistic about What actually, how are they first built? Like, what is a depth camera? You know, what is time of flight? Like, IR? And what are the current cameras that are exciting you? I think you were just mentioning a few. And perhaps if you can extrapolate, like, what will they look like? How will they function over the next 5 to 10 years even?
Yeah, those are great questions. So, let me think about where to start. So there was a moment that felt kind of dark for us from the standpoint of new sensors, and this was around the time that the original Kinect had been kind of EOL, the end of life, and there didn't seem to be that many new ones that were very good that were spinning up. Now I do have access to information about what's coming next that's not necessarily in the public, and it does make me very excited about what's coming out. But even in terms of what's public right now, there are some extraordinary sensors, and there's follow-up generations to many of the sensors that we've used in the past. I think one of the most interesting things is that the Kinect project was kind of deemed a failure in the way that it was set up, which was as a lifeboat for this Xbox project. And it was supposed to really bring something there. And it was incidental that like we were literally hacking the Kinect drivers in the beginning to make it work for our needs, right? And so the fact that they've announced a new generation of the Kinect, which is considered sort of a follow up to the HoloLens in a sense, because the HoloLens requires the HoloLens is an extraordinary project, and it requires really good depth sensing in order to be really stable. So the follow up to that has been announced and will be coming out soon. And so this is a new Kinect that's actually more geared towards our needs. And that team is doing, they're wonderfully engaged with the community. They're doing this fundamentally differently than the way they did it before, where they're asking their development community what they actually want and integrating that and kind of designing SKUs and models, et cetera, that suit our needs. So we feel very excited about those. There's also...
Oh, interesting. Okay.
One of the original sensors was called the Asus, and there's now an Asus 2 that has been released. PMD, which was one of the original kind of hardware companies in this space, has released a host of sensors that are kind of suited to this work. There's a company called Orbeck who are out, I believe, in Seattle, and they're doing extraordinary work in this space too. So they have, I think, a sensor called the Astra, and they're going to be releasing new sensors in the future. So I would agree with your characterization that it was sort of I just think that your information might be slightly outdated. Like, it was a bit of a dark moment. And then now it feels like quite a renaissance. Now, they're not all, we want the world, right? So these are not all incredible sensors. And so one of the things that we've taken it upon our team to do is to assume mediocre input into our tool sets and then make magic of that. So one of the most kind of exciting offerings that we're bringing out to the world is the ability to super resolve and enhance the input from these kind of mediocre depth sensors so that you can create something that we consider to be of a sufficient level of quality and stability to be able to tell stories.
Is it working similar as the SLAM algorithms from Microsoft? So maybe it's a background. When you use a Kinect, it technically can produce those different depth pictures, and you can like extract them. You can make like one picture or like one depth picture and use it, and you will see a lot of noise. But when you use the technology from Microsoft, where they integrate them over time, you kind of walk around the room, and suddenly the room becomes sharper and sharper, and less noise is there. And here, I guess, there is a distinction between the quality of just the sensor and also the magic that happens behind it. And I guess what you just described is the magic that integrates the messy picture into something that is consistent, right?
In a way.
I think you're talking about super resolution, in a sense, like to upscale already captured like RGB data to becoming like a higher resolution image or texture.
Yeah, let me clarify something. So I think what you're describing from Microsoft are a host of techniques that are designed for scanning static objects.
Yes.
And by kind of almost like accreting additional depth imprints, you can start to filter, because you start to know more and more about the world, and it becomes better and better in quality. It's similar in principle, but we're actually operating in a fundamentally different way. We're treating these like video cameras in the sense that every frame is new, at least right now. And so what that means is we are, again, filming at, you know, around 30 frames a second, and you're just taking an imprint of that person. And so a lot of the work we're doing is taking that depth information and it's interesting to know that, and you guys probably know this, but it's interesting to know that fundamentally it's basically like a video stream. It just happens to be a different way of encoding information about the world, where you basically get a color or a luminance value for each distance, right? So if something's close, it'll be bright, and if it's far, it'll be dark. And so we're taking that input, and it's inherently noisy. It's a very difficult thing to do this well. We take that as an input to our system, and then we combine it with high quality color information, video information from the camera. The two have been well calibrated together, so we know exactly how to fuse those two. And what we're able to do is it's kind of a comes from a domain called sensor fusion, which is used in, well, essentially everything we do nowadays, but any of these technologies that we're using right now, or remote, like autonomous driving, or Oculus Touch, or Tango, the whole principle is taking multiple sensors that are individually inherently weak in certain areas, fusing them together and using their relative strengths to make a better global output. It's quite poetic, actually.
Yeah, let me give a very short example. So you have, for example, a high-pass and a low-pass filter you can apply to a gyroscope and a magnetometer. A magnetometer is like super bad at, very short time resolution, but super good at long time measurement. But an accelerometer is super good at like a short time distance, but when you actually do it over time, there's a drift. But when you do a high-pass filter and low-pass filter and sensor fuse them together, suddenly you have a very stable controller like I have right now from the Oculus Go. So it's basically combining the information from the different noisy sensors and applying them towards a new picture, right?
That's exactly it. And in this case, we have a video camera, which is...
This is why I love you, Peter.
He's like, I got this. It's actually quite simple, though, like when you think about this. So we have this... Video cameras are designed to be very good at certain things. They're very stable in terms of they do a very good job of capturing the world with very low noise, at least in the visual range, right? And so they're all optimized that way. And if you think about it in terms of X and Y, or sort of left and right and up and down, as you look at that, they're very stable. They're not going to tell you lies in the area that they're specialized. Whereas with the depth sensor, there is a lot of variability. It's going to send a signal that is going to have little holes in it, little errors, little issues. And also in the kind of Z direction, the distance, you're going to get inaccuracies. And so we're able to, again, take the strengths of each of these, where a video camera has no capacity to, aside from depth of field, it has no real capacity to tell you about the shape of the world. And yet the depth sensor does. And so we fuse those together. And as a result, we get a very high resolution, quite stable output, which is a kind of fused volumetric format. And we use, as a matter of philosophy and kind of principle, we use, again, videos as a way of encoding this. And so what it allows our users to do is to take this volumetric material and edit it in something like After Effects or Premiere or Nuke, or do whatever they need to do, and use conventional video players inside of Unity or in the web to stream it.
Mm-hmm. So actually, that's such an interesting concept that I need to dig a little bit into that. So how would you be able to like edit a volumetric video in Premiere? So if you're encoding it onto a video file, what does that video file look like, or what would it look like on the editor side for you to be editing such a thing?
Sure. So I can speak about this project I mentioned. It's called Zikr, Z-I-K-R, which was filmed in Tunisia. So the Sensorium team, John and Matthew, they come from a background in video production, and they're very, very masterful in this. And they did conventional video production. Now they do 360 video, and now they're starting to get into volumetric video. Neither of them have any real experience in computer science. So they're not inherently skilled in that area. So what they were able to do is use our tools, generate the output from this. And what they see coming out of our tool set is basically a video frame, a big rectangle, where one portion of it is a particular kind of encoding of the depth information, and the other portion of it is the color information. And they've segmented out the background, and they have only the character, the person, presented. And then what they're able to do is you take that into Premiere, and you might do audio kind of audio cleanups, or lay back the audio, or create transitions, or create effects in a kind of simple something. Say you could do like a crossfade, or if you wanted to, that kind of thing in two dimensions, in Premiere. And once they're finished with that, they then export that just as you would a video, and they can bring it into Unity. So they had a really interesting process where it very much looks like a video production pipeline that eventually just ends up in a 3D rendering. And so when it, what they do is they use a conventional video player inside of Unity with our plugin. And our plugin takes that video file in and basically re-extrudes it. It kind of explodes it back out into the world, and then gives them the ability to kind of creatively refine this if they want to. So they can choose to represent it just as the people looked, as the people were in the situation as captured, kind of realistic, quote unquote. And, or we have a lot of kind of elaborate kind of aesthetic and visual effects techniques. So they can explode it as a point cloud, or they can make it dematerialize, or all of these things that we find that, that creators actually oftentimes want to be able to take reality and actually step beyond it, to expand beyond it creatively. And so in their case, they made this gorgeous project that does this. It's sort of, it's all about Sufi ritual. So it's all about kind of devotional practices. And specifically in Sufism, there's a kind of physicality to it, at least in some kind of sects, where dance is a big part of it, part of your actual creative practice, or your sort of religious practice. And so they were able to kind of integrate a kind of magical, sort of ephemeral quality to certain moments in their piece using this rendering technology.
Mm-hmm. So I think, to be honest, I'm quite impressed by the idea that you could store volumetric information in a flat 2D picture, because there are like different approaches. Like you could do point cloud capturing of a scene, and then you need to stream a point cloud, which it hence, unfortunately, is very big, because if you take every frame, then you have like multiply the amount of point clouds you have in one scene by amount of frames. It's a lot. You could do some kind of light field capturing, right? Where you capture the light field of a scene, and then you don't have the geometry, but you have the realistic light representation. But itself, light fields are huge. And even when some companies are working on streaming and compression, and for example, my colleagues doing some magic there, it's still far away from being, you know, editable, consumable and editable for someone who is not like informatics affine, right? Who doesn't have a degree in computer science. I think this is the magical sweet spot that you somehow landed in a very unique way, where you enable people to use the tools they have, but also to use few other magical devices and magical plugins that just stick it together and they can work with it. So I think this is something that defines your success very much, right?
I believe so. And I think it's deceptively simple. We built the tools that we needed, and we actually needed them to work. We needed them to work 5 years ago. And, you know, we started this project in 2010. So we needed them to work for us today. And we have embraced different constraints than many people in industry or research do, which is that they often say, we constrain our project based on the notion that it has to be absolutely immaculate. It has to look perfect all the time. And they are willing to make huge sacrifices in terms of flexibility, mobility, the politics of accessibility. We're not even getting into that, right? And they are willing to just throw all of those things out the door in order to kind of climb a mountain towards a kind of pristine quality. And we've been willing to embrace creative intervention as a way of avoiding quality issues occasionally. And we've focused on accessibility. And so, yeah, we have been able to do this, and we're very proud of it. And, you know, it has its strengths. It has its weaknesses. We're constantly tempted at kind of taking the research approach, because it would be so much easier in a lot of ways. We would get so much further faster, probably, if we were just willing to say, look, I'm going to choose the 6 people in the world and in various organizations for whom this will work. Where that's just not the world that we choose to live in. Anyway, based on that, what we've chosen to do is to make it more accessible. And that has led us to video. And it's not an insignificant challenge. Video is a miracle. It's a miracle that it works at all. And if you're working with video in a very precise way, it's extraordinarily difficult to do that in a performant way. We have an incredible team here. And even then, we encounter parts of tool sets and SDKs, et cetera, that just aren't very mature because people don't use this. They don't use video this way. So it's not a small challenge, but I am very proud that we've made this choice.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of accessibility, so in a sense, when you see the market right now, unfortunately, Google somehow killed Project Tango, and now the phones use just one camera as a pixel that has like 2 pixels, where they kind of guess the depths, or they use like 2 cameras and use like sensor fusion and can understand how the phone moves. Yep. And in a sense, it kind of killed off on the one realm the accessibility of an average consumer to technology that is being able to understand space. However, now you see a trend with the selfie camera being able to understand your face, like the camera from the iPhone X, right? That actually does structure light and understands your face. And you also have, in fact, in a lot of laptops, those cameras that scan your face for Windows Hello, right? So the technology is somehow more and more inbuilt in our everyday devices, but there's still like a gap for a consumer to access any type of volumetric technology, right? There is like no easy, oh, I'm going to get a 360 camera solution, right? When do you think this will change?
Let's see. I mean, I try, even just to keep my sanity, I try to focus on one problem at a time. And our first challenge right now is to be able to support people who are semi-professional in their field to do high quality work. And I believe that adoption, like mass adoption, is very important. And I relish it because I at that moment, I believe that we can really engage with what's important for people with our tools. And so I look forward to that, but I'm solving the problem ahead of me right now, which is about how can I make an intuitive, a powerful tool that people can tell the most meaningful stories of our moment in this context. So we are very excited about, how do I say this? All depth sensing is not created equal. And a lot of phones nowadays, they will sense sort of relative depth. So you can kind of know what's in front of something else, but it's not absolute. We are very excited about the iPhone X or 10 or whatever we're calling it. And it is quite powerful. It's not amazing, but again, keep in mind, we have plenty of experience working with inferior sensors. And so this is like the good old days. And so we have an application that we've made internally that is extraordinary, and it's very clean and very powerful, and it's really fun to play with. But again, I'm focusing first on the people who are really asking us, who are frankly kind of demanding of us to create tools for them.
Absolutely.
Right. You're making things for what exists right now, and you're making things to make things right now, for sure. And I think that's a better way of approaching the space, rather than really trying to like extrapolate for technology that isn't yet existing. Mm-hmm. But I guess that's a great example with the iPhone X. It's I didn't even consider it as anything depth sensing, but Face ID is completely based on like IR cameras, and it is creating essentially a depth map of your face.
It is. It's a low power Kinect. You can think of it that way. And it has sensors on the front and back. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. It has sensors on the front and the back, and the one on the front, the one facing you, is more like the Kinect one in the sense that it gives a proper, quite reliable, structured sense of the world. It's not totally relativistic in the way I was describing. And then the one on the back facing, outward facing one, is a, if I recall, it's a stereo pair, and it's less robust, partly because the baseline, the distance between the two cameras, is not very big. So it's a challenging problem, right, to do that well.
But I think it's important maybe to look at these phone manufacturers or hardware manufacturers wanting to integrate depth into their products, and filmmaking kind of being a byproduct from that. So like by Apple integrating, you know, Face ID or the TrueDepth camera into their phones, the main reason why they wanted to do that is for security reasons. But from that, there's a byproduct of like, oh, you can also do Animojis and, you know, whatever interesting 3D face capture application. So I think probably if we're trying to extrapolate to the future, that's probably going to be the way these technologies move forward, is they piggyback off of other use cases.
Yeah, that's why
perhaps like VR and AR will also be.
Yeah, that's why I'm here fundamentally, right? We took something, we saw its potential, and we used it for something else. And then the company that created that, Microsoft in this case, chose to then embrace the way that we were using it and support that and actually invest in that. And we have a philosophy that creativity and this kind of innovative sort of experimental engineering approach can actually change the world. It can change, it can steer these massive companies to start to embrace the use cases that we request and that we demand. And we actually see that happening. And I see no exception here. I believe that it's our job, it's our task to, by making meaningful projects that hit people on the level of the heart, or the family or the personal story, that they will see what the tools that they have made are actually for. And that's our mission, you know, is to continue to do that. And it applies to every one of these companies. Fundamentally, they have discovered new capabilities, or in many cases imitated the capabilities that they've seen out in the world. And with all due respect to these extraordinarily creative engineering teams, they don't know what they're for yet. And we believe that it's our job, and it's the job of our community of users, to show them, and not just tell them, but to actually show them what these tools can do, by making stories that, you know, move them.
Yeah. I to wrap things up here, I want to bring it full circle to something you mentioned earlier, when you were on the 777
yes,
or 777, and you were reading this philosophy book about photography, and how you made this comment about, like, photography almost, well, how did you describe it? Maybe you can remind us of exactly what that was that pulled you away from traditional photography. And maybe if you can relate how this new medium is perhaps a response to that, or does it, you know, does it fix those problems, or kind of fall within the same realm?
That's a wonderful, wonderful question. I mean, there's a kind of poetic irony to this, which is that I went from this world where I felt, I mean, clearly I was very privileged in the sense that there's so many people that wish they had the career that I had. And so keep in mind, this is my individual little existential crisis. But I was frustrated by the fact that I was being requested to just take hundreds and hundreds, thousands of pictures, basically. And that I lost touch with what a single meaningful picture was. The irony is that I went from there to a passion for photogrammetry, which is almost even more of that, right? So if just for your listeners, when a person is creating a photogrammetry capture, you look ridiculous, because what you're doing is you are, you look sort of like an alien that's never seen anything before.
Yes. And terrible tourist.
Yes, exactly. You're like a tourist with terrible aesthetic taste. And so what that means is you're looking at every single surface, right? You're photographing every single surface. You're taking, in some cases, thousands of photographs of a kind of minute area. So I had an experience of that. So I've been obsessed with photogrammetry since, for a very long time, using it for personal projects and experiments and integrating into our work. And I found it to be totally liberating. And part of it was I started to see the world. And this is one of the powerful things for anyone who's fallen in love with photography. You learn the craft, and then the craft somehow teaches you to look out in the world and be really entranced by it, right? So, you know, a lot of times they'll learn photography, and they'll discover flowers, or they'll discover sunsets, or they'll discover their family just because they're suddenly focusing on it.
Yeah, because the technology forces you to focus on it, because the technology helps you to reduce everything, just focus, and then that kind of finds this beauty that you kind of want to capture, right?
Yeah, precisely. And so I had the experience with photogrammetry that I found a kind of renewed passion for photographing. And also, I think I learned that how creative engineering is, and also how fascinated I actually was with how these tools work. I've sort of rediscovered a passion for this, because I'm not taking the shape, the kind of intended purpose of a given device for granted anymore. And I have the privilege of working with this extraordinary team here to be able to take ideas for what these tools can be and actually make them real. And that is it's a profound privilege.
Cool. I like that. Yeah. I think you said something that I totally resonate with, was photogrammetry made me like fall in love with the places that I was trying to scan, because you end up spending so much time there, especially if it's a darker place. Like, you will end up spending, you know, 2 seconds, 1 to 2 seconds per exposure of each picture. And I've had to spend like 7 hours inside of this chapel that, you know, as a tourist, you go in there, you spend, you know, maybe a minute or two, take a selfie and you leave, which is what we saw most people doing. Mm-hmm. But this, because the work takes so long to capture these things now, maybe I think that's, you're saying that that is inherently makes you appreciate the thing that you're capturing even more.
Yeah.
Because it's not easy.
Yeah, it really isn't. And forget processing it, right? So, yeah. Are there any cool kind of other topics that you guys would love to cover?
So if we have time, quickly talk maybe about what you think about. And you know, there was like this Kickstarter project for this new 360 3D camera that kind of can also do a depth field. And the question is whether a depth field could help in the context of volumetric video and additional information.
Yeah, okay. I buy all these things because they're all very exciting. So there's a whole crop of 3D sensing, you know, inside out 3D sensing that's happening. And there are a few of these Kickstarters. There's another one that's kind of originating in Shenzhen that's happening right now. That's a similar project. And fundamentally, what they do is they give you 360 images and a matching depth map or geometry if you want it.
Right.
Also the same work is coming out of Facebook and Google.
Yeah. That's
in collaboration with Red, et cetera. So this isn't inherently new, but it's very exciting. And we are, you can believe that we are very intent on that and very focused on integrating depth maps of any kind.
Nice. How about we do an episode in 3 months again? So now we have your background story and the next episode will be about the magic future.
I love it. Sure. Works for me.
Yeah, that would be cool. I'm into that. Cool. Thank you, Alexander. How can people find you if they want to reach out to you and kind of like talk more about these subjects, and how can people find out more about DepthKit and Scatter?
Sure. So you can reach me on Twitter at Alexicon, Alexicon 3000. And you can find us on the internet at scatter.nyc, and that's S-C-A-T-T-E-R. And then DepthKit, you can go join the beta, download it, etc. at depthkit.tv. So that's DEPTHKIT.tv.
Cool. I like the .nyc domain. I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah.
I wish there was one for SF.
We had to send them paperwork to prove our status.
Oh boy.
Very cool. And you can reach us you can find the Research VR podcast on Twitter at the Research VR. At Research VR Cast. And you can find us on Discord as well. We have an awesome Discord community channel where we have a lot of our post episode discussions with our audience, and as well as guests actually join us in there as well and kind of have like back and forths with listeners and previous guests. And we're starting to really build a fun community of professionals that want to talk about these subjects. What else? We have a Patreon. We have a Patreon account that you guys can donate to if you like the podcast and want to help keep the virtual lights in this room on. And next week, this is probably going to be way past when you are actually hearing this. Next week, I will be speaking at the Volumetric Filmmaking Meetup in New York that you guys actually are co-producing. And it'll be hosted at Vimeo. So I'm very excited to go there and meet the rest of your team, meet all these other filmmakers that are going to be around and are using these technologies. I think it's awesome that you guys are doing a meetup because it's still such a small community within this niche of VR. And I don't know too many other people that like and know these things, so I'm excited to see what it's going to look like. I feel like it's going to feel like SVVR meetup back in 2014, where it was like a bunch of, you know, VR lab people that worked together, like showing their little demos and seeing which one, you know, which one of these ideas are sticky and will be around. So very excited about.
We look forward to having you. We were actually surprised to be completely overrun the last time we ran it, and we look forward to having you present.
Nice. Yes. I'll be showing off some of the stuff that I haven't yet publicly shown or announced or teased even. I'll have demos, but I don't think we'll be able to, we're doing demos at the event. I'll show some videos and some recordings of those things. So that'll be super fun.
Beautiful.
Cool. And thank you Alexander for being here and for talking with us. And thank you all for listening. See you guys next
time.
Bye. Bye. Thanks so much.